frostbite.
Call to order this meeting of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee. We have the minutes of the previous meeting of March 3rd in the folders. Are there corrections to the minutes?
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
On page 2, just before the end, I know there's two sentences that both say, Senator Larson moved the Senate File 457 as amended to be reckoned pass. Not only is the sentence repeated, but it doesn't say what happened to the motion. I believe it prevailed.
That correction will be noted.
Otherwise, I'll move adoption of the minutes of the March 3rd, 2008
Senator Betzel moves adoption of the minutes as corrected. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Olson. Senator Olson has a timely bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your timely scheduling of this this hearing at the beginning of the State High School Boys Hockey Tournament. We'd like to do a little quick kickoff here with some help.
We will race with a stick and a pair of blades. On the ice we cut our teeth. We took our knocks in the penalty box.
Thought that would be a good
softening us
a good setting the stage for the bill that's before us, which is asking the legislature to designate the ice hockey as the official state sport. I'd just like to tell you how it came to be. Last spring, a few days before the end of session, Mr. Frank, who's here today from the Groveland Elementary School, brought his fifth grade class over here to tour the Capitol, and we were out on the Capitol steps afterwards. Yeah, I have to say it was one of the most enjoyable classes that I've in all the 25 years I've been here that I had a chance to have some conversation with and respond to really good questions. And when we were finished, this young man, Brendan, came up to me and said, you know, as part of our studies, we've been looking at the state symbols, and we noticed that there isn't a state sport, and we think it should be hockey. Can you help us? Well, what are you going to say? I said, of course I'll help you. And I said, we can't do it this year because we're just a few days from adjournment, but I said, I think I can get a bill introduced, which I did. I thought, see, Hockey Hall of Fame is in Minnesota. Whose district is that in? Senator Tomasoni. So he signed on and suggested that Senator Metzen was also a strong hockey player, and he signed on, and in went the bill. And it's just kind of sat there until now. But I've kept track of Brendan and his partner in advancing this idea, Hannah, and they are here today with me to present this bill to you. And we have a little bit more testimony. We have some testimony from Mark. I've got a mental block here. Mark Jorgensen, who is the executive director of Minnesota Hockey, and we'll take it from there. So, Brendan, you're the introduce yourself by name and then tell.
My name is Brendan Broviak, and I'm 11 years old and attend sixth grade at Minnetonka Middle School East. And today I'm going to tell you about the bill. The reason that me and my friend Hannah started the bill was for a project that Mr. Frank got us into before the trip to the state capitol. And we were challenged to propose a bill to take to the state capitol to present to a state senator. And Hannah and I both play goalie for the Minnetonka Hockey Association, and we came up with the idea. And Senator Olson was really excited about our idea and wanted to support our bill. And one of the couple reasons is would be the best sport to represent Minnesota is that it is the land of 10,000 lakes, and also could be the land of 10,000 hockey rinks because they all freeze up to make great hockey rinks. And Minnesota, it's also considered the youth hockey capital of the nation. I got that off the internet. And hockey is a sport that builds teamwork and camaraderie, and it takes us as adults that tie our community together. And many kids that play hockey and grow up, they continue with the involvement. And I wanted to be this bill to pass because, you know, we're already called the state of hockey, and it's the Wild's creed, the state of hockey. So we just need the state to state it in the history books. And I believe that Governor Pawlenty plays some hockey of his own, and I'm sure that most of you either play it or love it as much as we do. And I just want to thank Senator Olson for giving me and Hannah the opportunity, and I hope you will all help to make this bill a part of our state's future. Thank you.
Wow.
And I also have me and Hannah went out to our neighborhood, and we collected some signatures for everybody who can't be here right now and who all want to support the bill. So.
Okay, we'd be happy to receive that petition if you'll hand it to the page.
Madam Chair, I think they have about 600 or more signatures on their petition.
Thank you for your testimony, Brendan. Is there any comment or question for Brendan from the members? I will comment that some of us love baseball more. Just to put that on the record.
Madam Chair, love and enjoyment of sports does not necessarily have to be mutually exclusive because the young people that are here, it was pointed out that some of them are ready. In fact, Brendan is trying out for baseball this next week. So it's
good man.
Baseball. Yeah. Baseball is the national pastime.
It's also my. Hannah, if you'd identify yourself for the record, we'd be pleased to have your testimony.
My name is Hannah Ayersman. I am 11 years old, and I go to Minnetonka Middle School.
Can you get a little closer?
East, and I live in Minnetonka. It's a couple of reasons I think that hockey should be a state sport is because it's you make a lot of new friends and teammates, and you have like heart for the game, who wants it the most. And it always says on the Minnesota Wild commercials that it's the state sport, but they haven't made it official yet, so I think we should make it official. And addition, there's 10,000 lakes that freeze over to make excellent hockey rinks. And Minnesota is considered the youth hockey capital of the country. Hockey is part of most Minnesotans' lives, as I think everyone has at least some family members or a relative that plays the sport or supports it. And there's a great deal of passion for hockey in Minnesota. In fact, every Wild game has been sold out since the start of Minnesota. Hockey is great exercise and builds good teamwork. Hockey not gives only muscle strength, but builds character strength. Last but not least, hockey is an awesome game, and is, most importantly, it's fun to play. I want to thank Jen Olson for supporting this bill and for making it happen.
Are there questions or comments for Hannah? Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Hannah, how long have you been playing hockey?
This is my fifth year.
Fifth year. Madam Chair and Hannah.
Senator Larson.
Are you, what do you play in the U10 level, U12 level?
U12.
Okay. My daughter is in the U10 level, and she'll be playing in a tournament in Minnetonka in about 2 weeks. So I'll have to look out for you. You're a goalie, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, that'll be fun to see you. Good luck.
Thanks.
Any other comments or questions for Hannah or Brendan? Mr. Jorgensen?
Madam Chair, just before that, I just wanted to call attention to the couple of handouts that are at your desk. One of them is from the Sports Illustrated website, the section on St. Paul that was describing why St. Paul was named a few months ago the Hockey Town USA. And I added a sample of the 50-plus Charles Schulz peanut strips featuring Woodstock driving a Zamboni. That's one of my favorite pieces of equipment at a hockey game. But one of the statements in that article says, hockey in St. Paul, and I would add in Minnesota, grows from the bottom up. And the other picture that I have provided for you are the three of the four children of one of my water aerobics friends. Two of them are termites, Jenna, who is age 4, and Robbie, who is age 6. And I watched them at the West Tonka Jamboree on Sunday afternoon go at it in full force. And it's wonderful to see that really, truly bottom up going on in hockey. And so I'm delighted that Mark Jorgensen is here as executive director of Minnesota Hockey, because he gives prime evidence to that claim. And I've asked him if he wouldn't just share a word about his personal history with hockey as well as his professional.
And Senator Olson, we assume that Robbie is missing his two front teeth because he doesn't have his permanent teeth yet, not because of playing hockey. Is that right?
I won't try to answer that question.
Mr. Jorgensen. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Day, did you have a question or comment?
Madam Chair, nothing important, but you two got the two oldest best hockey players that we have in the whole capital are sitting back there. So yeah, and I'm the oldest guys. I missed the early introduction. So
Madam Chair and Senator Day, we'll get to them. I'm glad they're here.
Okay.
As soon as Mr. Jorgensen is finished, we'll bring them on into the act.
Mr. Jorgensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today about the great sport of hockey. As Senator Olson mentioned, I began playing hockey in southwestern Minnesota, not necessarily one of your hockey hotbeds, at age 5. I lived across the street from the hockey rink, and I would put my hockey skates on, rush home from school to put my hockey skates on every day, run across the street with sparks flying to make sure I was the first one to the rink. And generally I was, but every once in a while a few of my friends, neighborhood friends, would beat me there. It's been a great sport for me, and on top of it, I now get to make a living by working in the hockey field. And it's absolutely wonderful working with great young hockey players like this.
But you played through high school?
I played through high school. I played Division III hockey at Hamline University and then had the opportunity to go overseas and play for a couple of years in the old Soviet Union. I think I was the first American playing in the old Soviet hockey system. So,
great.
It's been an interesting journey, to say the least. There's no sport so interwoven into a state's culture as hockey is in Minnesota. Maybe football in Texas, maybe basketball in Indiana. We have over 160 local community-based hockey associations in the state, from Roseau to La Crescent, from Grand Marais to Laverne. We have players playing from age 4 to, as I was corrected earlier today, I found out about a gentleman playing who's 75 years old. So it's a lifetime sport. Minnesota Hockey, the USA Hockey affiliate here in Minnesota, governs youth hockey in the state. Minnesota Hockey is separate from the high school league, which governs high school hockey, with a girls' hockey tournament taking place recently, the boys' hockey tournament taking place this week. Minnesota Hockey registers almost 62,000 youth players, referees, and coaches. When you add high school players to that, we have over 70,000 people in the state of Minnesota directly involved in hockey, and that doesn't include the over estimated 100,000 volunteers throughout the state who make youth hockey run as we know it today. We register more youth hockey players in the state than any other state in the nation, over 44,000. That comprises 11% of the total number of hockey players registered in the country. We register more girls in the state than any other state in the nation, 9,467. And that's 16.5% of the total girls registered to play hockey in the country. We routinely provide more hockey players to Division I and Division III college programs in the country, almost 900 this past year. Over the past 5 years, we've provided more players to U.S. national teams, both men and women, than any other state in the nation. 25% of national teams in the past five years have been made up with Minnesota women, and 26% of men's national teams have been made up of Minnesota hockey players. In addition, Minnesota continues to provide some of the most skilled hockey players playing professional hockey in the NHL and in North America, and it's now extended to overseas hockey leagues. Eric Westrom, an Apple Valley native and Minnesota resident, was the leading scorer in the Swiss Professional League this past season. We've had more players drafted into the NHL than any other state in the nation over the past 6 years. So as you can see, Madam Chair, Minnesota truly is the state of hockey. Thank you.
Are there questions or comments for Mr. Jorgensen or for Senator Olson? Senator Larson, do you want to make? Senator Larson would move that Senate File 2313 be recommended to pass. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? And we do note that the Senate President, Senator Mattson, and Senator Tomassoni were present to show their support, and Senator Bonhoff, who also has part of the Minnetonka School District, was in the room to show her support. Well, as well.
Madam Chair, you know, it was interesting. This was an opportunity to get to know some of my own colleagues a little better. I had no idea of the life that in hockey that Senator Tomassoni had. I was reminded of it when I heard the almanac question this fall on our long-running public affairs program on public TV that Senator Tomassoni was the answer to an almanac question. And it turns out that he had played in the Olympics for Italy. So my first day back in session, I had to apologize for my ignorance to Senator Tomassoni. But he has had, I don't know if you have a minute, because I think there's a lot of people that don't know. Would you mind if he just shared a bit letting people know how much that's played in his life?
Talk to us about hockey and your life. And I also note that Senator Larson mentioned that his daughters play hockey, and I see Senator Weaker in the audience, and I think your daughters are also hockey players. So,
Senator Weaker is responsible for our getting the hockey song here. He said, "You've got to play that first." Right. So he gets this has been a team effort.
Senator Tomassoni.
Senator Olson, Madam Chair, and committee members. This bill's about ready to pass, so I don't want to screw this up. So, but to Senator D, I got to tell you about Senator Mattson and myself. You know, the older we get, the better we were. So, you know, what I might have to say here might not be true. But, but at any rate, I played hockey all my life, and I actually continued to play until I was 38, and My association with the Italian national team was a lot of fun and was pretty interesting. And I tell people all the time that I made millions, but it was in Italian lira. I was over in Italy for 16 years and played in several world championships and in the 84 Olympics. I think probably just as precious to me was my time at college when I played at the University of Denver. I would add some to what Mr. Jorgensen just added, but he summed it up pretty good about how important hockey is to the state of Minnesota and what a legacy it has. And I have a list here of about 178 players that are from Minnesota that played in the NHL to give you an idea of how good it was. And I'm going to tell you one story about back in the 40s and before I was around. And this is a pretty interesting story because that's when there were only six teams in the NHL. And two goalies, they were both from Eveleth. One was Sam Lopresti, and the other one was Frankie Brimsek. And Frankie was playing for the Boston Bruins, and he was known as Mr. Zero because he got a lot of shutouts while he was in the NHL. And Sam Lopresti was playing for the Chicago Blackhawks. And in the game, it's still a record-breaking game. Sam Lopresti had 80 saves in the game for Chicago, and that's still a record. And Boston ended up winning the game 3-2. So they had 83 shots on goal in this game, and it was a pretty interesting game. Now, I don't know if Senator Metzen ever made that many saves in a hockey game, but I do know that he's in the record book for the state high school league. So he had some pretty good state high school appearances also, something that I never got the opportunity to do, but my son did play in a state tournament, so that was a lot of fun also. But I can tell you that this state tournament that is going on in the state of Minnesota, there's nothing like it anywhere in the country, and to think that in the next 4 days there will be over 100,000 people watching the games live, not to mention all the people that will be playing on television, it just gives you an idea of how important the sport is to the state of Minnesota. And you know, if it hadn't been for these kids, Senator Metzen and I would have never thought of making the state of Minnesota or hockey the state sport. And so you got to thank the kids for coming up with the idea and for Senator Olson for carrying it forward. So thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I don't want to spoil it either, but I just, it's some closing thought that crossed my mind. You know, we're really a very sports-oriented state, and it isn't an issue of trying to belittle any other sport because many are participating in more than one, But obviously, hockey holds a very special place in the heart of Minnesotans. And I thought, in a state that, you know, that holds festivals celebrating winter, and where villages spring up on lakes throughout the state for ice fishing, and then the lack of snow that restricts cross country skiing and snowmobiling brings out mourning, mourning. It shouldn't be surprising that gliding over a sheet of ice with thin steel blades, carrying a stick, chasing a hard piece of rubber, would be transformed into an art form in Minnesota. And I think that it has. It's exhilarating to those who participate in it, and it's a source of enjoyment and excitement for all of those who observe it. So I do would appreciate if you would agree with these young people who had this great idea and push this on its way to making ice hockey the official sport of Minnesota.
Indeed. Senator Larson renews his motion that Senate File 2313 be recommended to pass. All who are in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
And Senator Olson, Senator Tomassoni, and Senator Metz. The next bill on our schedule is Senate File 2408, Senator Dibble. Is he here? I thought I saw him.
Oh, yeah. Just talk to Nate. Oh, no, I wanted to do this back in 19.
Senator Dibble, welcome to the committee. We have Senate File 2408 before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's nice. I don't think I've been back to this committee for a while. I don't think I've been back to it since I served on it, so it's nice to be back. Madam Chair, what Senate File 2408 seeks to accomplish is to allow the City of Minneapolis to enact an ordinance that would regulate the use of engine braking on 394 as traffic comes in past Penn. Through my district there. Madam Chair, the issue is noise that is distributed into the neighborhood from the use of these devices that large semi-trucks use to slow themselves down. Engine braking, commonly known as Jake braking, is a device that's placed on engines of trucks. It absorbs the energy from the engines, uses an air compressor to absorb that energy, slow down the engine, and slow down the truck without using brakes as much. And it creates a tremendous amount of very, very disruptive noise. And in that particular location, Madam Chair and members, the noise, the neighborhood, part of the neighborhood sits on a hill that overlooks that area, and there's a bit of a pitch, a bit of a grade downward. It's come around on 394. Many, I'm sure, are familiar with that stretch. And when trucks use the device, the noise just flows right up the hill and is very, very disruptive to the folks who sit over the freeway, as well as it
Senator Dibble, is it also an annoyance in the Bryn Mawr?
I would guess.
Does it carry there too?
Yeah.
There
are some walls in some parts, Madam Chair. There is a bit of a barrier with the field, but I have no doubt. But I hear more from the folks who sit atop, and there's a ridge there, and they sit atop, and a lot of the noise is just simply amplified, and it makes its way up the hill and is very, very disruptive. If folks aren't I'm sure most are familiar with what I'm talking about. It's that staccato, that bellowing staccato, as trucks slow down, that can be very jarring and very annoying. All this bill seeks to do is to kind of toss the ball over to the city of Minneapolis and allow them to take some action. If they have a debate over the subject, they can enact an ordinance and then request that the Department of Transportation place signs letting truckers know that using these devices is inappropriate in this full urban setting. Madam Chair, I'll just a couple of quick points. These aren't a safety device. These are designed to save the wear and tear on brakes. That was a question that I asked, and the answer I got back quite explicitly from the department. It's perceived as a safety device, but it's not a safety device, and there are no restrictions on local units from taking this action. I think Transportation Council and Local Governments Council, Mr. McGowan, had some conversation, and so we have legal standing to take this action. I have Ron Bining here, Madam Chair, who is one of the affected neighbors, who can share some of his thoughts.
Mr. Bining, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you. I'm Ron Bining, and I live in Kenwood, directly above 394. I've lived there for about 7 years. Even after renovating my house and putting in soundproof windows, what I'm finding is that the frequency of this has increased, and I don't think it's just my perception of that, and it is the point now that I can't, because of what happens in the morning, 3, 4, 5 in the morning, I can't actually sleep with windows open in the house. Because it's an abrupt sound, when we bought the house, we're used to having traffic noise. This is jarring. And that is one thing when you're becoming sleep deprived around that situation in the summer months, or you keep windows closed and you can still hear it through these triple glazed windows. I have a home office, and so when I'm trying to conduct business, again, I cannot during the day have a window open, because if I'm on the phone, you know, we're about 800 feet probably from the freeway. It really is a quality of life issue, anything that could be done to kind of reduce, we already deal with a large amount of noise, and this is, I think, the static noise that goes on behind isn't a big deal. But this abrupt sound is quite a problem. And it just so happens that we contacted Senator Dibble about this. I think that with enough time, I probably could have gotten a bunch of neighbors up and down my street here to probably talk to you about what the impact is on their life. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bining. I just want to clarify for myself. The proposal is to permit the city of Minneapolis to adopt an ordinance rather than the legislature imposing this. Is that correct, Senator Dibble?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And then they have to, even after that, then they have to go through all the local approval steps that are outlined in the statutes, and that includes a public comment period, does it not?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, my question is why MnDOT isn't doing this. I think I have a community in my district. I didn't know it was the MnDOT's authority, not the local government's authority, but I thought MnDOT had taken care of it. But in this case, why don't you just ask MnDOT to do it? Have they said no? Are they objecting to it for some reason?
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, MnDOT is here. And they can speak for themselves. I think they'll indicate that they're not crazy about this for whatever reason they have.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If the city of Minneapolis passes such an ordinance, do they also get to put in the penalty if the Minneapolis law enforcement stops somebody for doing this? Or is there a standard state penalty? Or how would that be handled?
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I'll look to council for help, but I will guess, and then council can tell me if I'm guessing right or not, that the city would have a penalty, enforcement and penalty authority.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, the city would have the authority to adopt an ordinance which could provide up to a misdemeanor penalty, which is, 90 days and $1,000 fine. So they would have the authority to set a penalty up to that authorized for ordinance violations, which is a misdemeanor penalty.
Senator Lurie.
Senator asked, Senator Dibble, I've got a technical question about the effective date. It seems a little circular almost. The city can't do it until the city has done it. It says the session becomes effective after they essentially adopt it. Why not just have a date upon which they can? Maybe this is for council. Why not just have a date upon which they can do it, and then it's out of our hands? They either do it or not.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, actually, this provision is enabling. It wouldn't need local approval. Sometimes local approval clauses are placed in legislation when it's not necessary. This is one where it really wouldn't be necessary, since it's enabling legislation, and by the mere act of doing it, the city is giving its approval. So, but sometimes, for whatever reason, authors request it or whatever local approval clauses are put in the law anyway. So I'm just saying it's not necessary.
So the effective date, Mr. Gowan, is just the one after which the City of Minneapolis, City Council, and Mayor had authorized the ordinance.
That's correct, Madam
That's
Chair.
That's what the effective date is saying.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gerlach?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'm still hung up on it. I don't quite understand. And I think the question's a good one. So if I understand, Council, the effective date, it's not necessary?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, you just have an effective date of the day following final enactment without local approval. Mm-hmm. That would be perfectly legitimate under the law. Or some other date, if you chose some other date.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of a funny way to express the effective date.
I would.
The House Council drafted this bill.
Senator, Mr. McGowan, do you have a more artful way of expressing the effective date?
Well, Madam Chair, you just simply state this section is effective the day following final enactment, period.
Senator.
Local approval is not required.
So it would be this section is effective the day after final enactment?
Day after, day following. Both terms are used.
Senator Dibble, would you like to offer that as an author's amendment?
Madam Chair, that would be splendid.
Okay, Senator Dibble. I know.
Okay.
Requests as an author's amendment that we delete on line 115, the governing body of, and then delete lines 116 and 117. Senator, and insert following the word after final enactment period. Senator Lurie moves that amendment. Is there anybody that doesn't understand it? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Further questions for Senator Dibble at this point. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if they're for Senator Dibble, but I'm not real familiar with this issue. I don't know what Jake breaking is, what the value is in it.
It's very
I assume
noisy.
It saves wear and tear. I don't pretend to know much about that. There's obviously a reason for why this braking mechanism is used, and I don't know what the pros and cons are. But I guess my question is that I guess this bill is before us because the cities don't have the authority to regulate the use of these brakes on the roads, apparently. But there must be 100 places within the city of Minneapolis where they probably would want, and this is written specifically to one section, there must be hundreds of places in St. Paul, there must be thousands around the state of Minnesota. Have we done these before? We haven't done these. Is this the first one where we're giving a city the authority to regulate, do an ordinance for jake braking?
I don't know that. Call on the
and are we going to have a lot of these from neighborhoods all over the state?
I know that there are occasionally, and I guess I don't know whether they're seeing them driving around Minnesota or other states where, like, near a hospital, they'll say no jake braking. Mm-hmm. And you can't do it there. If there's a highway near a hospital, there'll be signs posted that you can't do it. So it's not something that's not done. Jake braking, control of that or regulation of that is certainly, if not common, it's not rare.
Well, Madam Chair,
in certain areas, and one that comes to mind that I've seen the signs. And this is not like downtown because you're not on a big highway or in downtowns, but I certainly have seen them near hospitals. No jake braking.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering what happens next when another neighborhood comes in or a city and they say we want to do it here and here and here. Are we going to be micromanaging all these individual requests?
Senator Dibble?
Madam Chair, there is a purpose for jake braking. I should qualify, as I was doing my research, I understand jake braking is a specific brand name, the Jacobs Vehicle Systems. They get a little anxious when signs are posted that say no jake braking, because it's engine braking.
Engine braking is the
general term, but jake braking is the common term. It's like Kleenex and tissue.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We'll call it jake braking for the purpose of this discussion. The purpose is to save on the wear and tear of actual brakes. It's a different mechanism to absorb energy from the engine and slow it down. And so I think a blanket permission is probably undesirable. I think, the Truckers Association is here, and they're not necessarily going to testify. I think they would become extremely anxious if we created some sort of blanket authority for local units to restrict engine braking anywhere they saw fit. This is a very focused stretch, and it won't affect the overall use of engine braking by trucks, as they go around our freeways all over the place, and prohibit them from using, a very, very small percentage of the time they'll be in this particular location that has this particular impact on a residential setting, and so we're trying to be kind of surgical here, recognizing that this is a very unique spot, very unique circumstance. You got traffic slowing down because they're coming up to the curve there. They're going to be entering the Lowry Tunnel or going off the other direction, and you've got houses that are situated such that they're dramatically affected in this particular tiny circumstance, and so that's what we're seeking to accomplish.
Senator Gimsey and then Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Out in our rural communities, quite often you see signs along the highways, especially major highways, where coming into a city, there's a sign that says noise ordinances enforced. I'm just wondering if local units of government don't have the authority, if you will, to institute a noise ordinance that could do the same thing. Couldn't the city of Minneapolis institute a noise ordinance and then post signs in those particular locations? possibly get away from the possibility of having to do this in each individual case?
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I suppose that is so. But does that send the specific signal that we're trying to send to truckers who are using their engine braking system in this spot? You know, we're trying to solve a very specific problem, you know, from, you know, that's being created by a very specific activity. So I think the answer is yes, but I don't think that would then solve our problem necessarily.
Madam Chair.
And they might consider modifying their noise ordinance with this language, too. Senator Pappas is next, and then Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I'll yield to Senator Marty. He had his hand up.
Oh, Senator Marty, and then Senator Roebling.
Yeah, one comment, one suggestion. I would hope that MnDOT uses this as a thing to take a look when they're hearing from local residents about noise or other types of problems, that they do take a look and see if they could do it themselves. I don't object to giving the city authority to do this. I just think in a lot of cases, MnDOT could resolve it on its own. And the question I had is legislative route number 107, also known as 394. Never heard of a road called legislative route. Where did it come from, Senator Council?
House counts.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I had never heard of it either until this bill, so I don't know what.
It must be, just a defined term, like the description of your house is usually something you've never heard of. Just know your address. You know, I mean, I don't know what, quote, addition or I'm in or something like that. So maybe it's just a legal term, legal description. Senator Roebling?
Thank you. Since MnDOT is here, I would like to hear from them.
Yes,
what their policy is.
They're on the list to testify.
Okay, because I'm wondering what the policy is for when. I know that they post signs because I've seen them. So when do they allow it, and when is it not allowed? That might help solve the problem here.
Is this growth or growth? Ms. Groth?
Yes.
If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, hello. My name is Sue Groth, and I am – that's fine. I am the Assistant State Traffic Engineer for the Minnesota DOT. And I think I can answer some of your questions. I'm not sure I can answer them all, but I'll do my best. First of all, I'm here today just to provide some information in our perspective. We're not opposing this legislation in any way. We do have a policy that we developed quite some years ago before I was here that we did develop in conjunction with the State Patrol and talking about enforcement of what we're enforcing here are our vehicle noise laws, okay, and those are established in statute, I think, through the PCA. And so with the State Patrol's input, we actually came up with the policy that we would install these signs on conventional roads but not on freeways. And the reason why we do not assign them provide them on freeways usually is because a freeway is predominantly a trucking route, and the perception, at least that I have from the trucking people, are that they do see these as a safety device, and so there's a difference of opinion whether they are or they're not. So we didn't want to impede their use of this mechanism on freeways, but on conventional two-lane roads, especially in the rural area, you will see these vehicle noise law signs. It says vehicle noise laws enforced. And what we normally ask, when those are usually requested by the city, we ask that the city pass an ordinance saying that they will actually enforce the law. And then once they decide that they will enforce the law, then we go ahead and put up the signs according to our spacing criteria. So it's usually at the request of the city that the sign actually goes up. Currently, there are none of these installed on interstate freeways, so this would be unusual. But we do require, when the cities make the request, that they install them and pay for the installation on their own. In this particular case, because it's going on an interstate, MnDOT would like the responsibility to do that ourselves, but we would ask that the city pay for the cost of that. Let's see. Putting these signs on an interstate, it does make it a little difficult. If you're familiar with that area, it would be a very challenging place to try to enforce vehicle noise laws right there on 394. There's a lot of In fact, in the place that I was just looking at, there's little shoulders, lots of merging and different thing. Where would you pull a truck off? And if there's more than two trucks out there on the road, then exactly which truck, you know, violated the law. So that would be challenging. And on 394, as on all interstates, spacing of signs are an issue. We did do some investigation, and we have found two places where we think we can place a sign in either direction. One would be on a bridge mount railing, and the other we would have to remove a route marker and put the sign up in its place, because we do have standards for how far apart signs need to be from a safety perspective to allow people to be able to read and react to them. So we think that we can do it. So normally we would be requested by a city to place the signs up. I guess in closing, we have two situations, and these are just for your information. On 169, before south in the Eden Prairie area, I guess, before that was a freeway, there were at-grade intersections, and we had, with the request of the city of Bloomington, we actually had these signs out in that area. And when we went to build the freeway, we informed the city, because we don't allow these signs on the freeway, that we weren't going to reinstall them. And the comment at the time from the city was, you know, that's absolutely fine, because we actually felt that the noise went up after the signs were installed. And that's just one example. And again, that happened also on Trunk Highway 61 southbound near Wabasha. There was another place where we installed these signs, and the residents also said that after the signs went up, the noise actually increased. And whether that's sustained or not, you know, I'm just saying that truckers, again, I think perhaps, I'm just guessing, see this as a safety measure, and it's there. I don't know why they would, but if once the sign goes up, they let it be known that they're there. That's happened a couple times. So I guess that's just our perspective and kind of how we've done things in the past.
Thank you, Ms. Gross. Any further questions for her? Senator Gerlach.
Quick question, I'm sure. If the bill were to pass as written, who pays for the signs? It doesn't specify that.
It doesn't specify that in the bill, but because it would be the city that would be requesting the sign, we would have the city pay for the sign. That's the way we've done it in the past with all the other cities. They have paid for the installation costs themselves.
Further questions for Ms. Groves? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to this bill?
I had a question for MnDOT.
Okay.
On the city expense.
Senator
is nothing else? I mean, I'm comfortable with stating that the city needs to pay for the signs, but upon your reading of the bill, do we need to say that, or is that already established in
Ms. Groves?
In procedures?
Madam Chair, our policy, the way our policy is that it would be a request from the city, and if a request comes from the city, then the city pays. That's kind of how it works. We wouldn't actually authorize the work until we received the check saying that we're going to go out and do it. And in this particular case, just these are, because they're interstate signs, they're more costly, because to actually install it, you have to close a lane of traffic, and it has to be done at night, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not a $200 sign. It's closer going to probably to, by the time you get the traffic control out there, closer to around $5,000 to do both of them. So just so that you're aware, it's not minimal.
Further questions for Senator Dibble? Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I'm reading the language of the bill, and it says, upon notification to the Commission of Transportation by the City of Minneapolis, the Commission of Transportation shall erect appropriate signs. One reading of that could be that the city of Minneapolis notifies MnDOT, and MnDOT has to erect the signs. I think it's vague as to who ought to pay for it. Maybe that's, you know, MnDOT's policy, but I'm trying to read what the language is, and I don't think it specifies.
I agree with you, Senator Betzel, and I don't. I think maybe we should make it explicit that the cost would be borne by the City of Minneapolis, Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I think that's wise.
Mr. McGowan, can you suggest a place to put that obligation in?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would suggest on page 1, line 12, before the period, insert, with the cost of the signs to be paid by the City of Minneapolis.
Senator Lori moves that oral amendment on line 12. Anybody have any questions about it? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Lori moves that Senate File 2408 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of the motion?
Go ahead. Well, I was going to suggest, does the Transportation Committee need
No, they did not request the bill. Senator Day.
Does it surprise, Madam Chairman, that doesn't surprise me, but anyway, that's where this bill should be. I know Senator Pappas won't like to hear this, but we already live.
Don't say it.
We already live in the communities where we have no trucks that go on an interstate now on 35E that goes through St. Paul, which would save a lot of energy. But I don't know of interstate highways across the United States where they would have areas that you could drive on an interstate and have not be able to use Jake brakes. So I just think it's bad policy. Not only that, I can't imagine but what every community we spend in Minnesota, and Minneapolis is an absolutely wonderful community with beautiful parks and homes, and I know that they want to keep the noise level down, but we spend millions and millions of dollars on barriers trying to help with noise mitigation as much as we can. So I just think it's a bad bill and a bad precedent to get started. So I would just urge members to vote no.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Lori moves. Senator Gimsey.
Well, just real briefly, the only Please thing that briefly. It seems like that we haven't done, and we've changed it now to where the city of Minneapolis will pay for the sign, the only thing that seems to be lacking here is the call from the city of Minneapolis to MnDOT. Now, it seems to me that for us to go ahead with probably a precedent-setting bill that could potentially bring in a whole host of others, maybe we should think twice about passing this bill and simply ask that the city of Minneapolis make that call.
Senator Dibble?
Madam Chair, I think it's appropriate to, we're simply allowing the city of Minneapolis to enact an ordinance that has all the requisite hearings and consultation and notices and that, and I think that's appropriate. I don't think we're setting a precedent. I think we heard MnDOT say that this has occurred in, from place to place in unique circumstances. I would be uncomfortable with this just happening, you know, in a private conversation between the city engineer and someone over at MnDOT. I would think that we would want this to be subject to a whole hearing. All the issues that MnDOT raised would be the subject of a discussion, a negotiation, a hearing process with full informed input. So I think that's the appropriate way to proceed in this narrow circumstance. This is a small stretch of interstate freeway in the context of with a unique set of geographic challenges. I think it's appropriate to allow the city in consultation with its neighbors and the affected industry and MnDOT to take a look at this. And if it needs to
last
go to transportation,
minute,
we're fine.
Last minute request. The Senator Lori is going to amend his motion the motion would be that Senate File 2408 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Transportation.
Madam Chair, I was going to recommend that myself.
Okay.
Serving on transportation, I felt strongly about its jurisdiction myself.
So Senator Lori moves that Senate File 2408, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Transportation. As many are as in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Wieger, Senate File 2330, P Education Partnership Establishment. We have this bill because there is an advisory group that is being established.
Yes, Madam Chair, and there is an A2 amendment that reflects guidelines from your committee that would put it in the form I would like, and I also have, if someone would offer, would like to have a subdivision indicating this section is effective following enactment.
We will. This is not the first committee that this bill is in, so we need to. It's not. This is not an author's amendment, but. Mr. Bodern, would you confirm that with the A2 amendment that the P20 Education Partnership meets, this bill meets the guidelines of this committee on establishing advisory groups, councils, task forces, and so forth?
Madam Chair, I did draft the amendment, and I used my best efforts to do so. And I think I heard Senator Wigger say he wants to put it was an immediate effective date in here.
Madam Chair, yes.
So then what I would recommend on the amendment, he can incorporate this. There's no need to vote on it. After line 2.9, add a sentence that says, page 3 after line 24, and that'll be a new, I believe that's a, Section 2, effective date. This act is effective the day following final enactment.
Okay, that will be added to the A2 amendment. Senator Wigger, if just for our own information, could you just give us a two-sentence description of what your bill is proposing here, and then we'll act on the amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, the P20 Education Partnership would bring together interests in early childhood, K-12, and higher education. In addition to participants from those systems, we would also include business, and they would focus on areas of mutual interest, primarily focusing on how we can improve efficiency in the system.
Thank you, Senator Wigger. Senator Larson would move the A2 amendment.
So moved.
Is there any discussion on the A2 amendment? Senator Betzel.
I'll note something that's in the bill, and it's also kind of refined in the A2 amendment, requiring a report to the governor and the legislature by November 15 of each year. That seems to me an unusual date, because in every other year the House is coming off an election, so you're submitting a report and you may not even know who you're going to be submitting it to, because people are going to be changing around. If the governor's been coming off an election, we may have a new governor at some point, and why would the old governor care what this report says? Maybe the new governor might. The Senate's going to change. So I don't know what purpose is served by submitting a report November 15. January 15 makes a little bit more sense to me. So,
Senator Wigger?
And Chair, I agree.
So, Madam Chair, on page the A2 amendment, page 2.
Did we adopt that already? Yeah, we
it's
did.
It's before
did
us.
We
no, no.
We have not adopted no. the
so
A2 amendment.
I would move to amend the A2 amendment, and maybe we can incorporate this on page 2, line 6, and change November to January.
Senator Larson incorporates that change in his amendment.
You'll also need it, Madam Chair. On page 2, line 9 of the amendment, I think it should be changed there as well.
Beg pardon?
There's a second place where that date appears. Excuse me, that's deleting it. Never mind.
So we don't care about that.
Are members clear of what the incorporation into Senator Larson's amendment is? All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak either for or against the establishment of this partnership? Questions? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wigger, there is a group that is currently meeting. Is it simply not in statute, or is it a totally different makeup, or is it expiring, or why are we bringing this now?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, there is a group that was formed in 2002, and it's the P16 Council. This is a reflection, the P20 partnership of in a statutory recognition, which is recommended by the Education Commission of States. We have many of the same members that are in the current P16 group there. the noticeable difference would be legislative involvement, and that's considered best practices by the Education Commission of States, and we have been in discussion with members of the current council about this bill.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
So that would be folded into this then, and with the addition of legislators and maybe a few other members that are listed?
Exactly, Madam Chair. Yes.
This bill does need to go to higher ed. Is there any other questions or comments about the bill, Senator, about just the meeting the guidelines is what we're doing, not the policy. Senator Pappas.
I may have to reformulate my question, and this bill will go to my committee, I think,
yes,
tomorrow. I did want to ask, though, Senator Wieger, and I know we have a long agenda, so I won't ask too many questions. The existing council feels like they're working very well, and they're an implementation council. Will this slow down their work?
Senator Wieger.
Will they have to, like, disband and wait until all these new appointments are made before they can, like, start again?
Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, I see this as a seamless transition, and many of the items in the charge are reflected on the current charge. But some additional items that the legislature is addressing, which the policy committees have been talking about already, and many of the stakeholders on that group are involved, and it would be up to the group to decide in its annual discussions on work plan what it would want to do. But there is no intent to alter the current work plan.
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, since you have the Department of Education providing the staffing for the group, and I believe right now they rotate it, whoever's the chair provides the staffing, do you have a fiscal note then for the bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, no. The department and, for example, the University of Minnesota, which now has it, has absorbed the costs, as have the participating organizations, feeling that it's important to be involved, so they're, you know, the groups participating would absorb the cost, and I believe that's reflected in the bill.
And Senator Pappas, we are getting into the policy of this bill rather than
so
whether
think more
the bill
about just the
makes
appointments.
The meets the guidelines, and since the bill is going to your committee, it seems like to me that your line of questioning is more appropriate there.
Then my only other question, Madam Chair, has to do with legislators that are appointed. It's a lot of legislators that you have appointed to this. And I'm just concerned about the time of legislators and the level. This is not really seen as a policy-making group right now. I mean, maybe it could become that. It's seen more as working out the nitty-gritties of implementation of certain things that legislators don't usually get involved in. So I just have some concern about having so many legislators on this committee.
And Senator Pappas, once the bill leaves your committee, it does need to go to the Rules Committee because legislators would be appointed, and they usually are very, very
careful,
much aware of additional burden or whether it's appropriate or so forth. So I think probably from your committee, that's where the bill would go if it's acted on favorably. Are there any other questions or comments? Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to speak either in opposition or in support of Senate File 2370? Seeing none, Senator Lurie moves that Senate File 2370 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Higher Education. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
Excuse me.
Thank you very much, Senator Wieger. The next bill on our agenda is, Senator Sharon present? Senator Lynch? Going down the list. Senator Saltzman? Senator Pretner Solon. Senator Pretner Solon has two bills. Senate file, we'll begin with Senate File 2706. Senator Pretner Solon, Senate File 2706.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have some handouts for this bill.
Senator Pretrin Solon, the reason why this bill is before this committee is?
It's just for Section 1, Paragraph B at the top of page 2, which concerns the work of the Department of Administration.
And so will you just direct your comments only to that section?
I will do that.
We're not going to be passing on the policy of this bill.
Okay. Well, basically, this legislation creates a voluntary energy efficiency and conservation standard for all private sector buildings, and the implementation standards would be facilitated by utility programs and incentives. The standards would be mandatory for state-bonded buildings, though, and once the standards are fully developed, they would replace the energy aspects of sustainable design guidelines that are currently used for this.
Administration and Commerce. Well,
but
how does
that's
that work?
This. It's going to replace the energy aspects of the sustainable design guidelines that are currently used for state-bonded buildings. And so these standards would be developed by the University of the Minnesota Center for Sustainable Design Research. And basically, that's it. These standards are fully... when they're developed, they would simply replace the energy provisions of the current sustainability guidelines.
And so the involvement of Administration and Commerce is simply to review the guidelines that are developed periodically. I'm just reading the bill.
Right.
And revise the guidelines based upon those standards that were developed.
Right.
And does the Department of Administration and Commerce support the bill?
They have been working with the Department Administration, and they are in agreement with this.
Okay. The reason why the bill is here is because it references the Department of Administration. Is there anybody have any questions for Senator Pretrin Solon? Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify in support or in opposition to lines 2.1 through 2.3 of this bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I think we can also probably, I'm looking at something else here on page four, lines
page
4.9 to 4.11. The commissioner shall report the legislature every 3 years. So when should the report come in? I mean, you know, a three-year period is a long period of time. I mean, you know, they can
Commerce,
basically
right.
pick it. I think having a date in there would be a good idea.
Madam Chair, that's the Commissioner of Commerce that it's referred to in that section there.
But I'm just pointing out.
Not talking about that. Well, where's this bill going to go after here?
Yeah.
To the floor.
To the floor.
It seems like to me you don't want to amend it on the floor. So why not have a.
Are they recording now?
On every 3 years beginning.
Recording now? So they're wondering when do those 3 years start?
Which year?
After 1 year, we will make the recommendation.
The effective date is the day following final enactment.
3 years after that.
Madam Chair,
when do you expect the guidelines to be developed?
The guidelines?
I mean, it's new language, so.
The guidelines are being developed, and after 1 year, then. They will make the recommendation on whether to continue the program.
So beginning in which year?
Next year.
Give us a year. That's all we're looking for. Every 3 years beginning in
next
beginning
year.
In 2009.
Beginning
the first
in 2009.
Standards will be developed in 2009.
And should we say, are they going to be begun? Are they going to be developed in 2009?
Madam Chair, every year they will be updated.
Yeah, let me clarify it.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
If they're going to be updated every 3 years, why shouldn't the report come every year based on the updating?
Madam Chair, what report are you referring to? I'm sorry.
On what Senator Betzel referred to, page 4, lines 4.9. This is an obligation of the Commissioner of Commerce, but why wouldn't the report, if they're going to be updated every year, why not have the report be annual?
Madam Chair, Sheldon Strom is here, and he can answer that for you.
My name is Sheldon Strom. I'm with the Center for Energy and Environment. We worked pretty hard on developing this bill. The three-year reporting is to make sure that the legislature is kept aware of the progress of this whole program. So it's more of a program.
No, we're not arguing or we're not discussing.
I'm trying to explain how it's different than the exact development of the standards.
The issue is when does the reporting start?
I think, as Mr. Carmody said, the first report would be in 2009, and the idea would be that it would be report every 3 years thereafter.
Madam Chair.
Senator Batzel.
My point is, if it says every 3 years, and you guys get to decide when you submit it in, you submit the report in August, there's nobody here. So it seems to me that you need a time period. We usually say by January 15th, every 3 years, then submit
beginning.
It. So that if 3 years, you could. It's any time between January 1st and December 31st. That's my point.
Madam Chair.
When should the report show up so we know what's on this list?
In the first year, it's not clear how long it will take to develop the initial guidelines. The goal would be to get those done so there could be a good report to the legislature next year.
So why wouldn't you want it to be, Senator Prettner-Solon, beginning in the report? Beginning January 15th, 2010, which would give the full year of 2009 for the development of them, and then thereafter every 3 years.
Madam Chair, that would be fine with me if somebody would like to make an amendment.
Some precision and allows the work to be done. Senator Betzel?
I'll move it and I guess give council leeway to word it properly. So,
Mr. Bodern, can you give us a clue there?
Madam Chair and Senator Bitzold, on page 4, line 9, after paragraph, after paren F, close paren, insert, I think I have this right, beginning January 15th, 2010, and every third year following, comma. And then you'll need to delete every 3 years on that same line.
Okay. Does everybody understand the effect? Senator Prettner-Solon, you're okay with that?
I'm fine with that, Madam Chair.
Just for some precision. You've heard the amendment offered by Senator Betzel. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion on the bill? Senator Roebling.
I heard Senator Solon say that it was voluntary, but I'm not seeing that necessarily in here. Like on page 4, it says the commissioner shall require utilities to develop and implement. So it says require. And I'm just wondering about the voluntary nature of this.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, it's a voluntary program for private parties. It's a mandatory for public-funded programs, for bonded programs.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Is that also for school districts and cities and counties?
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
this
is Sheldon Strom again.
We're getting a feel from our jurisdiction here.
The mandatory nature is for bonded projects, state bonded projects, and then there is a requirement that public utilities implement programs to help help everyone else, the private sector, local governments, and so on. So it's voluntary for all private sector organizations, and it's voluntary for all local governments that aren't getting state bonds.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator Betzold moves that Senate File 2706 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank
Senator
you,
Prettner-Solon, Senate File 1918.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this bill is bringing Minnesota into the 21st century by asking the governor to appoint an ultra-high-speed broadband task force to make recommendations to the governor and the legislature regarding the creation of a state high-speed broadband goal and a plan to implement that goal. The task force is created according to the committee's guidelines for establishing task forces, so I'll walk you through the bill based on those criteria. The name of the group is the Ultra High Speed Broadband Task Force. Currently, there is no similar task force that exists. There are 20 members, although there is an amendment, Madam Chair. But currently, the bill calls for 20 members on the task force who will be appointed by the governor. The governor is also responsible for designating one of the citizen-at-large members of the task force to serve as chair, as well as to convene the first meeting after all the task force members have been appointed. The requirements for member representation on the task force are described in the first section of the bill. And the bill attempts to create a balanced representation of metro and rural perspectives.
Mr. Bodern, does the
A4
bill
amendment
as presented here meet the standards in our guidelines, as far as you know?
Madam Chair, I have reviewed the bill, and it does seem to fit with the guidelines. And I do have the amendment ready for Senator Sullivan whenever she's ready to proceed with it.
Hand me the amendment. It is the A4 amendment, and it would then, this is not an author's amendment because it's not the first stop, but it is adding some members, as Senator Pretner Solon just explained. Are there any questions about the amendment? Senator Lori moves the A4 amendment. Any questions about these additional members to this group? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there anyone who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to the amendment or to the bill? And do members have questions about the task force makeup itself, not the policy?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
It's on the reports again, page 2, line 17. The task force is supposed to submit a report to the governor and the chairs and the ranking members of the legislature by November 1st of 2009. So that'll be about 2 months, 2.5 months, or whatever, before the second year of the biennium. So it'll show up, and who's going to be able to? I mean, we have staff here full time, and members kind of come and go, but shouldn't you give them additional time and maybe have it ready in early January so that they would, we've actually got people here that can start doing, act upon it. I mean, I don't know what November 1st is going to accomplish.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel,
we
were considering a January 1st deadline. They were afraid it was going to get caught up in the holidays, and they just felt it would be better if they had a November 1st deadline.
The other issue that, what if the current governor, on that year, would like to have that report this early?
Well, again,
there might
Madam
be
Chair,
a justification for it at this point.
Yeah, this will be midterm in that biennium. We used to always require reports on January 1st, which made absolutely no sense.
Right.
And so over the years, whenever I've spotted that, I suggest January 15th, simply because you get through the holidays, you get some time to finish off the report and get it done. If there's a reason for November 1st, that's fine, but, just recognize that some people may be hurrying up to meet a deadline only to have the report sitting around for 2 months before anybody's going to really seriously look at it. And I don't like to waste people's time doing that.
Madam Chair.
But Senator Bretner Solon.
Actually, there was a lot of discussion about this, and the date was changed several times. And it was decided it would be at the end of November. Then it was the fear that it would get caught up between the holidays. This gives the report a chance to be submitted on the 1st. If a committee chair wishes to hold a committee meeting in the middle of November before the holidays to review the information in case legislation needs to be forwarded and prepared for the next session, that was the basis for the rationale.
Well, Madam Chair, since it's going to expire, I guess, March 1st of 2010, and it appears to be just a one-time report, and it's in the middle of middle of the cycle, I guess, I suppose no harm, but I guess we got to pay attention so that, again, I don't want people to hurry up and get a report here and then be mad because we're not acting
taking
on
it. Up.
Point well made. Is there any person who wishes to speak either in support or in opposition of Senate File 1918? Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Solon. This is a question as it relates to the amendment we adopted, and I know we already adopted it, but I see that it's going to three members for telephone companies. I'm just curious why. It looks like everybody else is one member or two members, one outstate, one metro, but this is three. What was the rationale for that?
Madam Chair, Senator Larson, the rationale was, first of all, that the ISP provider is not usually we're replacing that person because it isn't somebody that has as significant an interest in this issue. And then it was decided that it would go to perhaps a small, a medium, and a large-sized telephone company.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 1918 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
Thank you very much, Senator Solon. Going back up to number five, Senator Sharon.
Jeez, these guys are available.
Yep.
Okay. Good afternoon.
Senator Sharon, Senate File 2767.
Thank you, Chairwoman Rest. I'm here to present a bill today, 2767, which is a bill that is expanding the persons who are able to request local impact notes. This legislation, as you can see from your copies of the legislation, changes the language that allows, upon request of the chair or a ranking minority member of a legislative committee, can make a request for a local impact, fiscal impact note for proposed legislation. And on the second page of the legislation, you'll note that it also says that a copy of the local impact note must be distributed to the committee chair and to the members when the bill is being heard. It's a simple bill. It simply says that we want to move a little bit sooner, a little earlier, to provide information for members of committees as to the impact legislation that we're passing at the state level may have on other units of government, on cities, on counties, and on school districts. And what we want to do, our investment in this and our willingness to do this, is about making certain that when it doesn't necessarily mean that we won't continue to move a project forward because of the outcomes of that, but that it will make it much more transparent. It will be clearer to us when we're passing public policy at the state level that we understand that we are making perhaps law that will have an impact on another unit of government and on their stream of revenue, which may not be the same as the state of Minnesota's. So that's the essence of the bill. I have with me today members, representatives of the League of Minnesota Cities, representative of the counties, and representative from the school districts, who would like to say something on behalf of this bill, in support of this bill.
But Senator Sharon, do you, and that's fine, they can come forward. We'll hear brief testimony from them. I'm very cognizant of trying to get through our agenda because members have other obligations at 5 o'clock.
And this will be very brief.
But do you know how often local impact notes have been requested by either the chair of the Tax Committee in the House or the Tax Committee in the Senate in recent history? Or maybe if your witnesses, Mike, could testify to that if you're not aware.
I guess I will allow Keith to answer that question, but I would like to say that one of the critical points I want to make about this as you consider this is that under the current bill, it's a tax committee. There are many bills that we consider that don't go to the tax committee that have fiscal implications on local units of government. So it doesn't allow us really as legislators to understand the implications of what we're doing in terms of maybe property taxes or other forms of tax assistance.
Mr. Carlson, if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercommunity Association. The bill before you amends the section of law that was actually originally lobbied by my association a number of years ago before I became Executive Director. So we are quite familiar with it. In terms of the number of local impact votes that are requested, before I answer that question, I think I need to acquaint the committee with the process by which those are prepared. These are not prepared by state employees. They are prepared by representatives of the various levels of local government and then assembled by Department of Finance employees for their subsequent transmittal to the author and by practice the chair of the committee affected. So, quite frankly, we're a little bit judicious in how frequently these are requested. Last year, a total of 4 notes were requested and prepared. We emphasize if we're going to continue to rely on the current mechanics, that we have to continue to be judicious if we're not going to overwhelm that current system or mechanics for preparing the notes.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Gary Carlson.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We'd like to thank Senator Sharon for authoring this bill. We did have discussions in the interim about ways to beef up and make the local impact note process work better for local units of government. We think that these are some small steps but important steps that will make the law work better and allow more legislative input into the creation of the local impact notes.
Ms. Schwab.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We'd like to thank Senator Sharon for her hard work here. This could be a very beneficial process as we go forward, and we're thrilled to be able to work with her, and this expansion is something that we value highly.
Members, this bill had been in the Tax Committee. It came back here for review by our committee, and it apparently is going to go back to the Tax Committee.
Oh, it is.
So you're being batted around, Senator Sharon. Are there questions or comments for either the witnesses or Senator Sharon? Senator Betzel.
The last sentence on page 2, a copy must be distributed to the committee by the committee chair to members of the committee when the bill is heard. I'm just not aware of any other place in statute where we put in statute how our legislative committees are to be run. Normally that's a matter that's done by, you know, House rules and Senate rules and so forth. I think that if there's a note and it's not distributed, I think somebody's going to bring it up and somebody's going to hand it out. But I don't think we ought to go down the road of putting in statute, you know, how the legislative
Senator
committee
Betzel, would you then
make a motion
to strike the new language on line 2.4 right. and 2.5? And since the author of the legislation anyway is going to get the proposed note, it's going to make its way to other members. Is there any discussion of that amendment, proposed amendment? Senator Sharon?
I support the amendment.
Madam Senator Chair. Roebling?
I don't know that we have to indicate that it has to be distributed by the committee chair, but I don't think it hurts to say that it has to be distributed when the bill is heard, because sometimes a committee chair may be eager to hear a bill and not wait for these local impact notes to come, and then we may never see them. So I do have a little concern about that.
Senator Betzel?
The same can be accomplished by just making it public. You know, if the document's public, you know, anybody can, you know, show up at a committee and, you know, have a handout or so forth. But as I say, you know, putting in here saying here's what you must do at a committee hearing, that's not appropriate for statute.
I think the question that Senator Roebling is raising, though, is what if a committee chair hears a bill before the local impact note is prepared, and then members do not have the benefit of the local impact note when the discussion of the bill is going on.
And Madam Chair, that's an appropriate question, and at least for how the Senate operates, you know, maybe we should, you know, take a look at our rules to figure out, you know, how we should handle the situation. I don't think that, you know, we should let the House feel how they want to do it. We can do it our way, but you know, that's the appropriate way to deal with issues that are unique to the legislature, not to put it in statute, though. Yes. It's a good idea. We just have
Senator
to.
Robin.
We ought to work it out, you know, how we want to work it out.
Madam Chair, I would just amend it and say that a copy of the local impact note must be distributed to members of the committee when the bill is heard. But and I'm just thinking of our last committee meeting that a lot of us were in, and it would have been beneficial for us, and now we could request this under this bill, for us to have asked the local units of government how much the bill on the extension of sick leave to care for parents would cost the local unit of government, since it affects private and public entities or employers. But I just want to make sure that if somebody goes through all the trouble of preparing these, that the committee members have the benefit of seeing them before we vote. So I guess I would amend your amendment just to take out by the committee chair instead of deleting. I don't know how that works.
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, but again, then you're allowing who's ever preparing these notes to decide whether or not the issue is going to be heard. If the committee can't hear it because the note hasn't been provided to us, I think that that's taken the legislator's prerogative away from even hearing bills. So I think we just strike the sentence, and then, you know, we want the notes. I think that it's an important piece, but not. I don't think this helps.
Senator Rumley, I guess I was leaning toward the argument that you're making, but I guess I find the last argument that Senator Betzel made more compelling, that person preparing the note could effectively kill the bill. And I don't think we'd want that to happen as a matter of statute.
Madam Chair.
So I'm going to support Senator Betzel's motion to amend. Is there further discussion?
I would simply want to say that there's not any intent in this language, so if there is something that's occurring in the language that would slow down a process of hearings.
We understand that.
That is not the intent of this, but, you know, if a hearing is in health policy, by the time it gets to health budget, we think by then we ought to be able to have something so that that's considered.
Well, I think the biggest change, Senator Sharon, however, is that the privilege of requesting local impact notes is extended to other chairs of committees.
That's correct.
That's basically what it is. So we have the Betzold Amendment to delete the new language on line 2.24 and delete line 2.5. All those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussion on Senate File 2767? Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm not sure exactly what problem we're trying to solve. Have we had an experience that these requests have been denied, and so we're trying to fix that? Or it seems to me this kind of opens things up pretty widely, and that we may have
Senator Larson, I think the point that Senator Sharon made at the beginning is that it's only the Tax Committee chair that can do that, and sometimes the local impact notes are attached to bills that don't go to the Tax Committee, and so wouldn't really be of any interest to them. And well, maybe, a budget chair might be very interested in requesting it.
Well, Madam Chair, I
shouldn't have to rely on the tax.
I don't entirely disagree with that, but rather than perhaps it looks, unless I need to understand the language better, it isn't opening the request up to the person who, or to the committee chair who's where the bill has been referred. It's opening it up to a legislative chair. Mm-hmm. And so a legislative chair is the chair of transportation wants a local impact note on a Veterans Affairs bill, it seems to me they can make that request, and that seems pretty wide open. And we may be getting more than we're asking for here, mm-hmm. is my concern. The language on page 2 that requires that the notes be delivered to the committee where the bill has been referred, it seems to me that perhaps that's a better standard, is that if it's been referred to the Finance Committee or if it's been referred to the State and Local Government Committee, the chair of that committee could request that note, or the ranking minority member. But I'm not sure we want committee chairs that aren't involved in that
the path that that bill will take to be making requests for local impact notes.
Senator Larson, would you feel more comfortable if the language on 1.9 said legislative committee to which a bill had been referred?
I would be far more comfortable with that, Madam
Chair.
Are
you making that motion to amend?
Madam Chair, a small suggestion. You could say a legislative committee with jurisdiction over the bill, which might deal with the problem of a subsequent referral.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I'd be comfortable with that, Madam Chair, as counsel is able to make
on
that.
On line 1.9, Mr. Bodern, you would suggest to Senator Larson to amend?
On line 1.9, before the period, insert with jurisdiction over the bill.
Any questions about
the proposed legislation.
Jurisdiction over the proposed legislation. Any questions? Senator Sharon?
I think it's an excellent suggestion, and I support it.
All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion of Senate File 2767? Anybody else in the audience wish to testify in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 2767, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Okay. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much,
Senator Sharon. Senator Lynch? Senator Lynch brings us Senate File 2811. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I come to you today with Senate File.
What issue brings your bill to our committee?
We have the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee. This, Madam Chair, is an expansion of an already existing committee. In part, the reason that I'm here today is on March 3rd, 1998, the Office of the Legislative Auditor did a program evaluation of school trust lands. It took me a while to get to the Senate, but now 10 years later, I bring you back to that date, and we are seeking to act on some of the suggestions prepared by the auditor during that time.
And the changes you are making
with regard to
you're adding chairs of
right.
You're adding legislators. So this bill will, if it moves forward, will go to the Committee on Rules. So you're adding to it, and then you're adding other people in the with expertise in other areas.
Yes.
Senator Lynch, have you reviewed the guidelines of this committee, and does your bill meet them?
Absolutely.
Mr. Bodern, do you agree?
Madam Chair, I have been involved in some of the drafting behind it and reviewed it, and it does comply with the guidelines.
Are there any Senator Lynch, I understand that the Committee on Environment has requested it first, but please note that when it's acted on in Environment, you do need to request that it be referred to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there discussion?
Madam Chair, there is an amendment in the packet.
Let's take up the amendment.
It's been drafted by the revisor. It's numbered A08-1259.
Madam Chair, I'm not offering any amendments.
Okay. Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, on page 3, lines 3.3 to 3.4, it says, notwithstanding section 15059 sub 5, the advisory committee is permanent, does not expire. I believe the reason why we have a provision in law is so that we kept creating advisory committees and then forgetting about them, and you know, we wanted to periodically review them. Now, sometimes all we did is extend them, but I think that the problem is that, you know, if everybody wants to just say, well, mine's important and it should never expire, mm-hmm. then why don't we just repeal 15059? So I think we probably need some explanation as to Well,
I know
why it's in here.
Yeah, I know that we have asked people to be sensitive to that, and if it is one that meets those criteria that you just mentioned, that they should so state that, and that it doesn't expire, so that we don't find ourselves in the place that we had this year, which was having to reinstate ones that we that were going to be permanent ones that had been deleted by mistake. But Senator Lynch, why should this be a permanent advisory group?
Madam Chair, Senator Butzold, I think, you know, recognizing the point that Senator Butzold made, this is the advisory committee that oversees the permanent school trust fund lands.
How long has it been in existence? Ms. Schwab, identify yourself, please.
Madam Chairman, Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. These lands were originally given to Minnesota as we became a state.
Well, how long has the advisory committee been in place?
Madam Chair, we're checking on the date.
But a long time.
A long time.
Senator, Mr. Botter.
Looking at the history of the statute, it appears it was first that creates the advisory committee. It appears it was first enacted in 1943.
Okay, I think that's permanent enough. Okay. That we'll want it to stay. Are
Thank
there
you, Madam
other
Chair.
Questions for Senator Lynch? Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if it's duplicative to have the chairs of the education committees of the legislature and then also the chairs of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over K-12 education budget. It sounds like the education committees would include K-12 budget.
It's policy. Senator Lynch, why do you feel the need to list the budget chair separately from education committees of the legislature do not include the budget chairs? Is that the case now?
Madam Chair, education committees at some point in time might mean policy and finance, but as it is currently today, they are two separate entities. And so I think we wanted to be very clear that we want both the policy and the finance divisions at the table.
Senator Lynch, when you say the chairs of the education committee, now Senator Pappas is chair of a education committee. Senator Pappas, are you on this group?
Not to my knowledge.
Not to your knowledge. might want to, if it's supposed to be K-12 education committee, we might want to insert that in the chair of the education of K-12 education and then also just leave your language for the budget division. Mr. Bonner, what do you think?
Madam Chair, and while I have the opportunity, I want to correct an earlier statement I made. I pulled up the wrong section to find the original date of enactment, but looking at Section 127A.30, which creates the advisory committee, the original date of enactment for that, it's a little bit younger, but it's getting pretty old, 1982. So that's been around a while, but not quite as long. And then getting to the question that you're addressing to me, on page 2, line 4, if you want to include the chairs of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over education policy,
And budget.
I think you could simply, after budget, insert and policy.
So we would, in line 2.2, strike after the colon the chairs, and then line 2.3, strike everything before the comma, and then on line 2.4, after or before the comma, insert an policy.
How would that read, Madam Chair? How would it read? I'm trying to. How would the sentence read?
The sentence would read that the advisory committee must consist of the following persons or their designees: the chairs of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over the K No. Okay, we need to make that over the K-12 education budget and policy. That doesn't sound very good.
Madam Chair, you could substitute finance for budget.
But it would, we'd have to strike the as well, wouldn't we, with jurisdiction over K-12 education budget and policy, or finance and budget policy?
Finance and policy.
What sounds best to the members?
Over K-12 education, finance, and policy.
Or maybe better to put policy first. Chairs of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over K-12 education, policy, and budget. I think that sounds better. Senator Lurie?
As you read that sentence, one more thing dawned on me. I think that we typically don't allow legislators to assign designees, as this current statute does.
We have had that issue before. But that is currently in the statute with regard to the other with the other legislators. I wonder if we were going to address that, that we would just need a statement in this list that said legislative appointees do not include designees or something.
Madam Chair. I apologize.
Mr. Nauman.
Madam
Chair.
You
need to identify yourself.
Eric Nauman with the Senate Office of Fiscal. It's apparently been the practice. I just spoke with the DNR, who has some workings with this, that if a legislator doesn't come, it has not been the practice of a legislator to appoint a designee. So I don't think it would be harmful if you chose to remove that.
It would not be harmful if we put that in there specifically.
I'm sorry, I'll be clear, Madam Chair. If you eliminated or designees, I don't think that would be a problem in terms of the operations of the committee.
What about the other people who are the members? I think that the issue is that legislators shouldn't be able to appoint a designee, not the other entities that are members of this advisory committee. Mr. Bodden, where would you suggest we insert that?
Madam Chair, I guess I'm not completely clear. I think it sounds like if you remove on page 2, line 2, if you remove or their designees, then I don't think it'd be causing any unintended harm. Looking at the list of people who are added to the group, I don't think the intent would be to allow them to select designees.
Either. Okay. Okay, well then, Senator,
currently they can't.
Just a second, please. Senator Lurie, what do you think about that?
I'm okay with it, but I mean, it would, I don't know, the superintendent from a non-metropolitan district, person with an expertise in forestry, you know, I mean, I don't know, sometimes we do, there's a couple of commissioners in here, I thought, further down the list, it would apply to all of them, and oftentimes we do allow some of those non-legislative member people to appoint a designee. I could go either way. I could cross out or their designee. I don't have a problem with it.
Commissioners aren't going to show up. Any other suggestions? Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, I mean, I'm not quite sure what the intent is here, but we could strike out, as Mr. Bodden indicated on page 2, line 2, or their designees, and then on page 2, line 6, after Committee on Ways and Means, maybe put a semicolon in there and say, and the following persons or their designees. So you clearly have a demarcation between the first group of legislators, the following persons, mm-hmm. and then another group of persons or their designees. But I don't know, did we intend to have the person with expertise in forestry or his designee? I don't know.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bodden.
If you look at the language down on lines 2.13 to 2.15, those individuals, the ones with expertise in the particular areas of forestry, minerals and mining, real estate, et cetera, are all personally selected by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. It mm-hmm. doesn't seem like the intent would be to further delegate that responsibility.
On that.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe we
could
strike out or their designees right now, and if there's a compelling case, for instance, the Commissioner of Education. You know, I mean, maybe we could identify Commissioner of Education, parentheses, or designee. So, you know, there's maybe one or two of these that are appropriate for designee, but strike out or their designees for the whole group, and otherwise, these are the people that have to show up.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the committee's consideration, currently the Commissioner of Education appoint a designee.
Yes.
I do think on line 2.7, those individuals that it would be helpful and perhaps appropriate to have that, as has been suggested with the semicolon, and the following persons are their designees.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, which persons should have a designee?
Medicaid,
Commissioner of Education. How about the superintendent. Two superintendents? Should they have a designee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon. That's Lynch, I'm sorry.
Senator Butzel. Commissioner of Education. And I would think that it would be appropriate for these both of the superintendents that were designated there, although it is it has been common that it is the superintendent that has been at these meetings. I think that it would not be detrimental to the committee if in a given situation a superintendent chose to designate that to someone on his or her staff.
Madam Chair, then maybe there's only three spots here that apparently are at issue, and we could say in 2.7, Commissioner of Education or designee, superintendent from non-metropolitan district or designee, one superintendent from metropolitan district or designee. I mean, it's a little awkward, but at least you've identified the three spots that can have designees and everybody else, you know, cannot. That's one suggestion.
Madam Chair, I would, Senator Butzel, I would take that as a...
Do we act on the amendment to bring the policy chairs? So we would leave in the language on 2.2, but then say, let's put it into one amendment. Okay, if you can do that, Mr. Bodern.
Madam Chair and members, the amendment would read as follows. On page 2, line 2, delete the chairs, strike the chairs. On page 2, line 3, strike everything before the new language. On page 2, line 4, delete the first the, and delete before budget, insert policy end. On page 2, line 7, after education, insert or designee. Let's say or the commissioner's designee. And after district, insert or the superintendent's designee. And on page 2, line 8, after district, insert or the superintendent's designee.
Senator Betzel.
Page 2, line 2, the current language or their designees would be stricken as well.
Right.
Yeah. Madam Chair, correct.
Senator Pappas. Senator Lurie.
That was my point.
That is Senator Lurie's amendment. Any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there anyone who wishes to speak in the audience in favor or in opposition to Senate File 2811 as amended? Is it going? Senator Larson moves that Senate File 2811 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Environment. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Lynch.
All
have a little bit of a time crunch here. Is Senator Olsen here? Senator Saltzman and Kubley, Senator Olsen's bill needs to go to another committee, and yours do not. So I think I want to take his first, and then we'll get to yours, and we will hear them. But I want to make sure that we get that one done today. Okay. Senator Olsen, you now have an obligation to be brief, if you can.
Madam Chair, I will. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 2988 is about Type 3 school buses, and these are the vehicles that are like a Dodge Caravan or a Suburban or a car that are used to transport schools around or kids around, primarily special ed, or for going to the debate team if it's a small team or math league or something like that. The reason I'm here today is because the last sentence talks about rulemaking. The commissioner may adopt rules regarding the qualifications and requirements for drivers of Type 3 school buses.
That is the issue that's in front of us and none other. The policy issues will be dealt with in the Transportation Committee and in the Committee on Judiciary. So what this bill is doing is allowing and calling on the the commissioner, and it's the commissioner of Transportation?
Public safety.
Of public safety to adopt rules. Is there any discussion on this bill with regard to rulemaking authority? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify in favor or in opposition to the rulemaking authority being granted here but to the Commissioner of Public Safety? Seeing none, Senator Lori moves that Senate File 2988 as amended. Was it amended in the first committee?
Second committee.
In the second committee, be recommended to pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
And opposed?
Referred somewhere?
To the Committee on Transportation. Senator Lori. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very
Thank
much,
you,
Senator Olsen. Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, members.
Senator Saltzman brings us Senate File 2605. Staggered terms for Met Council members. And I keep calling this the elected Met Council bill, and it has nothing to do with that. And so if I make that, if I say that again, please, I don't mean it. It's not what I'm saying, but I tend to say that. So, Senator Saltzman, this is the first committee, and you have a request for an author's amendment.
I do have an A1 amendment.
It is the A1 amendment. Senator Larson moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. The bill is now in the shape that the author would like it. Senator Saltzman, please present your bill.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of this committee. I want to bring forward this bill, Senate File 2605, that will change the Met Council to stagger terms. There was a bill last session for an elected Met Council. This is a much more modest proposal, but does address some of the questions, concerns, and issues that have come up is how we might have some minor reform in the Metropolitan Council. This past June, there was a major regional conference that brought together the members of the Metropolitan Council, county commissioners, legislators from our metropolitan area to talk about the history of the Met Council, its accomplishments, but also its challenges, and then sometimes questions. And as a result of this, this seemed to be a very a modest proposal to address some of those issues and, you know, providing for greater continuity, addressing also that the Met Council has a little bit greater sense of independence, but also having the governor very much involved in the appointment process. So I do have three people here with me to testify briefly on this to give some background. I do want to note that when the Met Council was first formed, from its inception in 1967 up through 1995, when the current situation occurred, the Met Council did have staggered terms. And so this is sort of resorting back to where it perhaps was at one point with, instead of 6-year terms, this
This is four-year terms. There is a amendment that addressed the fact that after reapportionment, after a census, when the areas may be changed, that the amendment would say that every other decade you would switch which of the member districts would only serve a two-year term after the reapportionment as well. The other piece that is in here is on line 1.17, where a member serves at the pleasure of the governor is removed. We believe that that's important because then members can serve them at council once confirmed, although there is a statement here that if there are grounds for removal with cause, that has been added. And I believe that was something that was brought to me by the Met Council, that they would like to see something in here with that. So at this point, I would like to introduce a former Met Council administrator, Mr. Solem.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Jim Solem. I live at 1975 Autumn Street in Falcon Heights, and as was indicated, I was the first regional administrator for the Metropolitan Council under the new structure, which began in July of 94, and I served from July of 94 till July of 2000, three chairs, and I think I'm the only regional administrator to have gone through a change in governors. The council is now a very large and complex public enterprise, a budget of $670 million. It runs two of the largest infrastructure systems that serve the region, wastewater and transit, as a park system, a housing authority, and a variety of other operational sub-entities. It has probably more than a dozen labor agreements, and almost 3,000 employees. I think it's the only sub-state unit of government, and staff can correct me if I'm wrong, that doesn't have some mechanism for continuity in the governing structure of the organization. So I think it's based on my experience, and I did go through one change of governors in which the governor retained only three council members, that it's given the size and complexity and the long learning curve for new members, that it is important to have more continuity than is now provided. You do have the possibility of an entire governing body and the senior administration changing, and I think that is not good responsible government and certainly not good fiscal management. So I think this legislation is important and urge that you pass it.
Thank you, Mr. Solem. Questions?
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Pappas.
Just a quick question for Senator Saltzman. The members will continue to be confirmed by the Senate? Yes, they will be.
Mm-hmm. Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, I got a question about the AE1 amendment that says a member may only be removed for cause. Would that be the governor that removes a member for cause, and how does the governor make that decision? Who makes that call?
I'd like to refer to Senate Counsel to answer what that clause means in terms of with cause, because it's not referenced.
And who does it?
Yes.
And also, shouldn't there be a period in there? Isn't that a sentence, or is that something else?
Madam Chair, it's before the period, so the period remains
before
in the bill.
Before the period, I'm sorry. Sorry.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, the governor would be doing the removal. It's always the appointing authority. And removal for cause would be, unless it's defined by statute, it would be the common law definition or the case law. And there's volumes of it.
Sure. Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel.
Mr. McGowan, then, governors do make some appointments that extend beyond the governor's term. I mean, to a number of other agencies. Do we have other provisions in statute that say that a member can only be removed for cause? Or, I mean, what happens if they make a PUC appointment or something like that and the governor decides this person is doing a good job? Do we have to say in statute that they can only be removed for cause? How are the other agencies handled?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, two of the four metropolitan agencies currently have removal for cause provisions, and numerous other, hundreds of other appointed position throughout the statute has removal for cause provisions, and the removal is always done by the appointing authority, whoever that may be.
Senator Betzel?
If nothing was said, because I don't know all the appointments the governor makes, if nothing is said, then do we assume that a member can only be removed for cause, or what assumption do we make?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, if it's the term is for a specific term, the presumption would be that the member would serve for that term. Now, there's a provision in 351 in which a vacancy is declared in certain, and that, you know, conviction of an infamous crime and things like that would apply. But in general, if it's for a specific term and there is no removal for cause provision, the member would serve the full term.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. McGowan. Senator Betzold, Senator Salzman, we can proceed with the testimony.
Yes, and thank you very much, Madam Chair. I also have Mr. Larson, who is the mayor of New Brighton, here with me today as well. So, Mr. Larson.
Mr. Larson, Madam welcome Chair, to the committee. Senators. If you'd identify yourself.
I'm Steve Larson. I'm mayor of New Brighton.
Are we pleased to hear your testimony?
Okay, thank you very much, Madam Chair. It is, I think a key word that's already been brought up is continuity. I've been on council, this is my 21st year, and we have staggered terms. And every time somebody new is elected, you have the, I think it's very important to have that knowledge base that has happened, something's happened before, it carries over. I think to start over new, if we elected, in, at least in my city, if we elected four new people, you'd come in and basically who would be making most of the decisions would be staff, because I don't think council would be up to date and up to speed when they come into the first month or first quarter to even understand what's going on. And I think by having staggered terms on a Met Council, you're going to provide that continuity and put the ownership on making decisions where it belongs, and that's with the members of the Met Council, not with some of the staff people making decisions. I think that it's very important, and it just makes sense. You know, I've watched other agencies in government as a past president, North Metro Mayors, and of the AMM, and how people work together, and you depend on that knowledge of the past to make the future better. So I think this bill will address that issue.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Larson. Questions for Mr. Mayor Larson. Senator Betzel.
I got an overall question, though.
Okay.
Testimony after that's done.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, the question I've got is the effective date. Because it's effective the date following enactment.
Senator Betzel, that is going to be a more general question brought up.
Sure.
And there are going to be two approaches, amendments, okay, that we can decide whether it's effective starting now or whether it's effective starting after reapportionment. But let's have the other testimony, and then we can discuss what is the most appropriate in terms of if we like the staggered terms, how quickly we want them to come into place. Senator Salzman, you had additional testimony.
Yes, I do. I have Terry Schneider, who is a council member from the city of Minnetonka.
Mr. Schneider, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much. Terry Schneider, 1533 Boulder Creek Drive, Minnetonka. And I've been an at-large city council member for 15 years in Minnetonka. Also served as president of AMM and on several Met Council committees in the past. I do want to echo the need for continuity. And it's not just the idea of a significant change in the Met Council makeup leading to a staff influence, but it's the fact that as cities, as major players in the region, are trying to implement the guide plan and the systems plans that are developed by the Met Council, we're making some very significant infrastructure and policy decisions that have some long-term implications. And if all of a sudden, in one foul swoop, we have a whole new Met Council that basically redoes those systems plans, our whole process is really upset, and significant cost implications can be incurred. So I think the idea of having that overlap and the staggered terms, providing a little bit of institutional history and not some major changes in any one governor's term, is a significant asset. So I would be very supportive.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Schneider. Any questions for these three witnesses? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. There is the issue that Senator Betzel identified. I had identified it earlier in the day with Mr. McGowan, and we have two proposals, in a sense, that we will distribute to address the issue of effective date. And basically, it is whether we want this to those who were in favor of it, if we wanted to start as soon as the next appointments would be made, or whether we would want it started only after the next reapportionment, which would mean that you would not be starting this. I guess I'm stating my own preference. We wouldn't be able to start this until the year 2013 because we would be waiting for the new redistricting following the census in 2010. Then we'd have it, the reapportionment, just like the redistricting for the legislature in 2012, and then the new districts in 2013. I mean, that's an option. Mm-hmm. But other than that, and that would be accomplished by the A2 amendment, if anybody wanted to offer that. The A5 amendment instead would start it on, make it effective January 1st of 2009. And Mr. McGowan, would you explain how the staggeredness would occur in terms of these terms? With the A5 amendment, I think we all understand the A2 amendment, correct? Wouldn't take effect until 2013. Mr. McGowan, what would be the effect of the A5 amendment if we adopted it?
Well, Madam Chair, the A5 amendment would require altering the terms of the current council members and have half of them, the odd number districts, end on the first Monday in January 2009. Right now, all the council members serve terms coterminous with the governor, and that would be until January of 2011. This would cut half of them off in the first Monday in January, January 5th of 2009. The governor would then make four-year appointments to those half of the council members.
And so it doesn't mean that the current members would necessarily only serve two years. This amendment would allow them actually to serve 6 years if the governor so chose to reappoint those folks.
That's correct, Madam Chair. And if the governor could just reappoint the existing members, and in effect they would get a two-year additional term. And then the rest of the terms would just stay as the law currently provides. They would end on the first Monday in January 2011, and then the governor would make new appointments for 2 years up until January of 2013.
Senator Saltzman, do you have a preference?
I'd like to hear the discussion of the committee, I think, first, because I think you may have another perspective on this. Because
expressions about, we don't have an amendment in front of us, but expressions about these two alternatives. Senator Larson?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Saltzman, I think I prefer the A2 amendment, and I'm willing to, I'll wait to offer it or to make that motion, but I think that when making this kind of change, people have been named to these mm-hmm. positions to just have us make that change this year for that quick of an effective date. I'm not sure that that's wise. They all may be reappointed, but they may not. And it seems to me that if we're making a change like this, looking out a few years isn't a bad thing.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, so with the current system, the appointees serve until the end of 2010. Is that correct? At the end of the governor's term?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, the first Monday in January 2011. So end of 2010.
Yes. Really. Madam Chair, then I think, I don't know how to get to this goal, but I think that if you're going to have a new governor coming in, I don't think you should have the entire council from the old administration, half the council maybe from the old administration, but that's the new governor should be able to come in, and that's the whole idea of staggered terms,
right?
Is to be able to appoint at least half the council. How we get to that, I have no idea.
So
that would be my preference.
Senator Saltzman?
So to that point, Madam Chair, then if you are trying to start the continuity earlier, then you would go with the A5 amendment, because that what that would do is that the governor would have the opportunity to reappoint or change current appointments, and half of those people would be those people would be staying on into the next term of whomever is governor, and then the new governor, right?
And that's then the, your comment about six
and then the new there. And the new governor would be able to appoint the other half. So if your intent is to start the continuity sooner, then it would be the A5. The governor would have the opportunity to appoint the same people if he chose to do that.
This governor would have.
Right, this governor.
Senator Betzel?
Well, and there may be a legal issue out there somewhere, the fact that the current council consists of people that have been appointed by the governor and already confirmed by the Senate for a particular term. Now, we would, in essence, but if we change that, essentially we'd be shortening the terms for some individuals, I would think, you know, who are currently already confirmed for a particular term to go through this term of office.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, you mean if they were appointed midway? Because if the current members have 4-year terms,
right,
they're appointed in 2006, they served to 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is that some of those people, half of the council would get to serve till 2012. Half of the council would be appointed by a new governor. I mean, certainly some people could be reappointed.
Yeah, of course, it's clean. The governor, they all serve, Madam Chair, they all serve at the pleasure of the governor right now. So the governor can fire anyone that he wants to, change them if he wants to. This would essentially be saying we're going to have the governor reappoint people that he's already appointed and we've confirmed. If he chooses the same members, he can do so in a way that's going to extend into the next gubernatorial term. At any rate, all their terms right now would end with this governor's term.
That's right.
If this governor were to be reelected,
actually,
he'd still have to reappoint them.
Yeah. Actually, the appointments of the Met Council members are before this committee and they have not been acted on.
Okay.
If the governor liked this bill, nomination of those members could conform to the way in which this bill is going forward.
Okay.
So I think that there is a proper way of dealing with the issue that you just raised, and the appointments would, since they haven't been confirmed, they could be redone with a shorter term in the confirmation request because we have not done that yet.
Okay.
I think we've solved that problem. Senator Larson, move one of these amendments?
Well, I'd like to first know if there's anyone from the governor's office that can give us an indication of how they feel about this or the administration.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Louis Jamboy. I'm with Metro Cities. I'm not with the governor's office, and I'm not with Met Council, but I talked with Judge Shettinen of the Met Council before he left for a family obligation. Mm-hmm. He hasn't seen the amendments, but the Met Council very much prefers this bill to previous bills that have been before for this committee. They have no general problems with staggered term Met Council appointments, but again, they haven't seen this particular amendment.
Senator Saltzman, have you had any contact with the governor's office?
I have talked to Mr. Shettinen, Madam Chair, and that was why we included the provision about that. I understood there was some concerns about not having any clause about a member being removed, mm-hmm. so that is why we added that. And generally, otherwise, there was not support, but they were very open to the idea, was, I believe, the term used, was they were very open to this. And that
Which
was why we moved
we
this
can
forward.
Ask for
you know, I
way.
Think probably the A2 is probably the cleanest amendment. But certainly if this committee believes that you want to start this earlier and have continuity, the A5 amendment offers that.
Senator Roebling, what's your thought?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think if we want to do what we want, we should probably go with the A5, because otherwise in 2010 after the election or 2011, we will have a whole new council and potentially a whole new administration. And I don't think that's really, I mean, I think we're trying to avoid that, perhaps. And so since we haven't confirmed yet, I think that could be part of the condition, or they would have an understanding when they come in for their confirmation hearing before us, that we would be looking at only a shorter term for some, with the potential that they could be reelected and shortly reconfirmed again. I guess I do prefer the A5. And no matter what, the new governor, it's a 16-member council, right, and then a chair. So the new governor would always get a majority of his or her candidates or members. So I think that I don't think that would be a big problem for a new administration.
I think we've had a discussion of the both approaches. Who would like to offer an amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
I'd like to move the A5.
Senator Pappas moves the A5. Is there further discussion on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A5 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the A5 amendment is adopted. Is there anyone else? Are there any further amendments?
No.
Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak either in support or in opposition to Senate File 2605 as amended? Seeing none, Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 2605 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
There, and thank you, ma'am, as well.
Senator Kubley. The EUTC committee obviously made an error with one of your bills. There was no reason for it to come to this committee because they took the rules provisions out.
Oh.
And that is Senate File 2749. That being said, Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 2749 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance.
Okay.
All
thank you, Madam Chair.
All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The other of your bills, however, does have a rulemaking authority in it, and would you explain why that is necessary and what you want the commissioner to be adopting rules for?
Well, I guess there were some safety concerns, Madam Chair and members, on Senate File 2756, and I do have an author's amendment that was drafted by the department to address some of the concerns that were had, but the rulemaking piece is still in the amendment as well, Madam Chair.
Senator Kubley, this bill would go to the floor next. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not aware of anyone else that has asked for it, Madam
no
Chair.
No one has requested it. So we will do you the courtesy of considering the amendment here so that the bill, when it goes to the floor, will be like you want it or like this committee deals with, and so that you would not have to offer an amendment on the floor.
Appreciate
is that
Madam Chair.
Is that agreeable to the members? Apparently. So we have the A2 amendment, and Senator Kubley, Senator Pappas will offer the amendment, but you will need to explain it since this is not the first committee.
Well, Mr. Bozicki is here from the department.
Okay.
Maybe we could hear a word from him, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
He was primarily responsible for getting the amendment drafted.
You'd identify yourself for the record.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Greg Bozicki. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Okay, and if you would explain this amendment.
Very briefly, the amendment requires rule adoption by the department. The rules, it is defined in the amendment what the rules would address at a minimum, and as Senator Kubley explained, these are for safety issues. The other component of the rule on line 1.3 clarifies that this is to address cargo tanks from between 3,000 and 5,000 gallons, and it does not address the nurse tanks that are in operation of less than 3,000.
Okay, is that clear? two people. Senator Pappas has moved that the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So, Senator Kubley, just briefly, the reason why you are bringing the bill forward, since we did put on a policy amendment here, would you just explain that again to us?
Oh, I'd be glad to, Madam Chair. There are a couple people here from my district also who could speak to that a little bit.
Forward.
And, you know, they have a little better handle on it, too. But although, you know, I don't want to steal their.
Sure.
Since they made the trip in, I'd like to give them a chance to speak to the committee.
Thank you for your patience in this very long hearing, and we're pleased to welcome you to the committee. Whoever would like to begin, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you. My name is Kendi Burr from Westcon Elevator in Holloway, Minnesota. And what we're trying to accomplish here is right now we apply nitrogen fertilizer from pressurized tanks knifed into the ground, and these tanks hold approximately 1,000 gallons. They are pulled by pickups in the fall out to the applicators in the field. There's some inherent dangers with anhydrous ammonia because it's in pressurized tanks, and anhydrous, means without water, so if you get it on you, it sucks the water. It gives you burns. It's dangerous to work with. And so we're trying to make the environment safer for our employees. We're trying to make it better for our customers and for the public just in general. And what we found, the mechanism we found to make this better is there's 5,000 gallon tanks that are being used now in some other states, which means that there's five less times to be on hooking up hoses out in the field, which is really the, in my opinion, the dangerous part of the operation. The tanks themselves are normally well built. They have safety valves on, things like that. It's kind of the human factor in there that I think that causes the problems. And so we can eliminate a lot of the human factor in there by going to bigger tanks. We also have labor problems out in west central Minnesota. Seasonal help is getting harder to find every year. By going to 5,000-gallon tanks, we would eliminate pulling all these 1,000-gallon tanks down the pickup. Last year, as an example, during a four-week period, we put on over 38,000 miles pulling these tanks. If we went to 5,000-gallon tanks, we would fill them with semi-transports after that, which would bring us down to approximately 5,000 miles on the road pulling that. So that's all. It's a labor plus that's a safety consideration there. And last but not least, there's also an efficiency gain for us. We can cover more acres in a day, and I think the morale for our employees are better and so on. So,
thank you. Sir?
Madam Chairman, my name is Josh Meezing. I'm the agronomy manager for Western Consolidated Co-op. I've been in the agronomy business for 31 years and also in the anhydrous business for 31 years. Over the past years, we've run about 80 anhydrous ammonia tanks in our company, and we feel it's a lot of tanks that are on the road every day. And by going to this new system, we'd like to get all them vehicles and tanks off the road and go to less tanks and have a larger volume one. Part of the problem we're doing is with the new law transferring in the field to these bigger tanks. We've been doing this for 31 years, transferring product in the field with smaller equipment, and we feel over the last 30 years, with improvements to equipment and safety equipment, that this would be a much better process of doing it.
Okay, are there questions for the witnesses or Senator Kubley? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am wondering how much these tanks weigh, because when we say other laws and rules to the contrary, notwithstanding, would we be waiving road weight restrictions if these are over the weight limits for our roads?
This is strictly going to be a piece of equipment that's going to be used in the field. We'll be delivering to the fields with a legal semi that's on legal for weights. But the approximate weight of this trailer is going to be about 10 ton, and the product in the tank will be about 10 ton. So nitrous ammonia weighs about 5.15 pounds per gallon.
So, Madam Chair. So how many 10-ton roads do we have out there in the rural area?
Well, this will be on a field implement trailer that's not licensed. This will be a field implement vehicle, and this will be hooked up to a tractor at all times. So the one axle weight will be on the back axles. There's a picture, I believe, on the handouts you got on the very last page that everybody should have got. And in the picture, you can see that half the tank's on the back axle of the trailer, and the other half the tank goes off the tractor axle. So all the weight is not on one axle.
Senator Roebling.
So, Madam Chair, I just want to make sure that, that we're not exempting them from weight restrictions that might
apparently
come on.
Apparently, they don't go on the road.
Correct. These are implement trailers are meant to go in the tractor. So wherever the tractor goes, we got to go from field to field. They'll be temporarily on the road when we're going from field to field. But this is not something that we use for hauling product to the field. I mean, this that's what we use a tractor and trailer with a licensed trailer.
You know, I'm looking at this picture. So the tractor with this big tank is what goes down the road?
No, nope, ma'am, that's what goes down the out in the field. It's hooked up to the tractor at all times. And we deliver out to the field with a larger tank. Yet, it's a regular. Currently, how we're doing to get the anhydrous to our place is we got a semi with a 20,000 gallon tank that holds approximately 20,000 ton. Excuse me, holding about 20,000 pounds, and that gets delivered right to the yard right now.
So the semi meets the weight restrictions.
Correct.
Currently.
It's perfectly legal. It went up and down the road already. Right. And we meet with all safety and DOT specs on that part of it.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
Even with the heavier weight, it's still going to meet the weight restrictions, so we're not exempting them by saying notwithstanding laws to the contrary. I just want to make sure they always have to abide by the weight limits.
Any further questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to this bill? Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Bond. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. Our members are the suppliers to farmers and also the custom applicators who spray pesticides and these applications on fields throughout the state. And I'm put into a bit of an awkward position. WestCon is a member in good standing of our organization. However, when they did not bring this idea through our policy process, and when we did look at it, we did have some concerns that were stated. And when it went through policy committee, we actually didn't comment on it. The concerns that we're now expressing, and on behalf of also the Feed and Grain Association, Bob Zelenka couldn't be here, so I'm speaking for them too, is that we do have some safety concerns about this large an apparatus in the fields. And I think the rule that you're considering, in fact, speaks to some of those, so we're speaking in favor of the rule. And if I might make a departure because you are considering policy, just to say that one of the concerns we have is a dislocation in the rural areas, and particularly the smaller co-ops, who are going to find an apparatus of this size, estimated in the last committee at about $200,000, to be prohibitive. And this is going to be for those small communities and those small co-ops a bit of a concern and a challenge for them.
Senator Kubley, do you have any response to his testimony?
Well, I don't, Madam Chair. I guess I think, you know, you have to allow people to speak from both sides. And, you know, so I certainly invited the crop retailers folks to come. So, you know, I don't know whether that would prove to be a reality or not. You know, I know that most of them are still dealing with the 1,000-gallon tanks. You know, I can certainly see where the folks from WestCon are coming from when they say it would take a lot of traffic off the road, that is, our slow-moving vehicles. And I know that the people who travel the roads like to see less slow-moving traffic on the road. So, I think that it is a safety issue. So I don't know. I guess I'm kind of torn, too.
It does seem to me, Senator Kubley and sir, that with the the specification now from the department of all the aspects of rulemaking, the things that they're to take into consideration, that that should give you at least some comfort with going to larger tanks. Is there further discussion on Senate File 2756? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 2756, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Kubley. And there is no further business before us. We will be meeting again on Wednesday, and this week we also have a this week and next week we'll be meeting on Friday. This Friday, is it all members' bills? All members' bills.
All members' bills this week.
This week it's only we're hearing bills only of members of this committee. So we're not asking people to stay over who are not members of this committee with bills that will be coming in front of us. The following Friday, we'll have to have bills from other members of the legislature, but we tried to concentrate it so it's just ourselves hearing our own bills. Okay. No further business. We're adjourned. Thank you very much.